Welcome to Walking in Faith, featuring interviews and reviews that help you rediscover the Catholic faith in our culture. And now here is your host, Barbara Schenkel.
Welcome to Walking in Faith. We have two guests for you this morning. First up, we speak with Mark Chrismeyer. He's here to talk about Gethsemane Ways Ministry. It's a first-of-its-kind ministry for dealing with addictions on a Catholic parish level. And then following that, we speak with Daria Little. She's written a book called From Islam to Christ and has a great conversion story. So stay tuned for those interviews. Good morning and welcome to Walking in Faith. This morning, we're joined by Mark Chrismeyer, and he's a member of St. Norbert's Parish in Paoli. And he's here to talk about a very special ministry he started there. Welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And I think drug addiction or alcohol addiction or gambling or pornography addictions, these are things that we know exist in our society, but we're really afraid to bring them up at church or to talk about them. Tell us a little bit about your ministry. I believe it's called Gethsemane Ministry and how you got started in this.
Yes, actually it's called the Gethsemane Way. And it's specifically designed for just what you're talking about. Addictions of all kinds affect probably almost every single family, and maybe even more so the Catholic families, because you know we're an amalgam of Northern Europeans, Germans and Irish and Italians and French and English and we know that there is a genetic aspect to addiction, particularly with drugs and alcohol. And there's a lot of intermarrying between us Northern Europeans. But it affects pretty much every family, and it's every family's worst nightmare. But it's something that the church is not talking about, only till recently. When I got into this almost 5 years ago, nobody was talking about it unless you were a rock star or a a movie star, and it was getting to be kind of a badge of courage that they had gone to rehab. But there's a tremendous amount of stigma still associated with it even today. And our son got involved with drugs, and he got arrested, which was a good thing. But we knew things were going on for a couple of years in his high school years, and he was stealing from us and stealing from his sister and brothers and other kinds of behavior. But what happened, as we were leaving the police station, the policeman said, or I said to the policeman, what about rehab? Because we were looking at the court system. And the policeman says, oh, well, yeah, the judges look really good on rehab, and turned to my son and said, what do you think? And he said, I think I need to change my life. And as anyone knows in this thing, when a door's open or the window's open, you got to move fast because it can close quickly. And so I immediately did two things. One is I went on the Internet. The great source of knowledge in our world today. And it's just, everybody's clamoring at you that our program's good, our program's better, we do this, we have a chef on call on duty, and we have yoga, and we have, it looks like a Ritz Hotel and all kinds of things. And then the other thing I did was I wound up calling four priests, two deacons, three youth group ministers, Catholic high school counselor, and I finally called Catholic Charities downtown. And to sum it up, I got pretty much the same response from the woman at Catholic Charities who said, wow, we don't get a lot of calls about this. And I said, wow. You got to be kidding me. Right. From the people who take care of the downtrodden and the homeless and when a large percentage have mental illness and addictions. And she said, I'll have the woman who takes care of that call you back. And 5 days later, the woman called me back and said, well, we refer them to the county, or to one or two of the major institutions around here. And by that point, I was 60 miles down the road. And because, again, you have to move fast. And I could not find a Catholic faith-based recovery program. Now, there are some programs that say that they're Catholic, or that they would provide you with a Catholic counselor and whatever, but they just didn't really sort of fit with what I was looking for.
Were you looking for a sacramental or spiritual approach to recovery?
Yeah, it was exactly that. I think that it's mind, body, and soul. And most of the treatment facilities, I'm painting some broad strokes here, and some people will probably be offended, but most of them are just all about the addiction and the person and not looking at the spirituality, although many of them have a 12-step approach that's integral into their treatment. But 12-step is changing as well. It used to be about God, and that was a higher power. In some 12-step programs, you can't talk about God or higher power anymore. Mm. Most people still do. But we felt it was important that, if you can find all these other programs, why aren't there any Catholic programs? And so we wound up sending him to a fantastic program called Teen Challenge. It's a faith-based program, actually sponsored in large part by the Pentecostal Church. And the other beautiful thing about it is that it's a 14-month program. And most programs are 30, 60, 90 days, and then you go right back home. And so this program is set up. I found some statistics from the federal government that if you can stay sober for 3 years, you have a 33% chance that you can fall back. If you can get out to 5 years, you have a less than 15% chance. So when you think about it, 30, 60, 90 days is, and then going right back home is just not an option. So that was the beauty of that. And once I got into it, I found that this program, they have chapel in the morning, and they have Bible study, and they have personal development. And I thought, gee, they have chapel, we have mass. They have Bible study, we have Bible study. And personal development, what are my triggers? Who are my friends? How do I deal with anger? those kinds of things. So, you can find those. So anyway, what we did is get him into the program. And it was like, when someone finds out about cancer, there was the denial. And then it went through different stages. And finally, it was, I don't really want to see those people anymore, because every time I do, I get high. And so it was a beautiful thing. But in our parish, people would come up to me and they'd say, gee, you talk about all your other kids, but what about, your son? And so finally I couldn't talk that way anymore. I just got, I said, gee, I don't feel honest. And much to my wife's chagrin, I said, our son's away in rehab and he's dealing with some issues. And the very next day, two women called me up, and one said, I never even thought about calling anybody at the parish. And the same thing from the other one. And I thought, boy, that's a sad testament to where we are. And Pope Francis says we have to be the field hospital, and we have to be out there in the trenches. And, we're not doing it. So anyway, we had in our local high school here, secular school, over a period of about 6-9 months, we had 3 overdoses of the opiate addiction. And as I was walking out of church one day, this mother came up, who was a friend of mine, and she said, what are we going to do about this? And I said, I don't know. What do you think? And she said, well, at least we can pray. And so I thought, nobody can argue with that. And so I went to our pastor and said that we wanted to start a monthly prayer night. And he had been in the inner city, Father Michael Lee, had been in the Grace Ferry area for 20 years. And he said, a week didn't go by where I was not burying someone because they were an addict or the son or daughter or some way addiction played a role in the death. And so he was all for it. And so what we did, started our evening of prayer for addictions, the Gethsemane evening prayer. And we start out with a short reflection that I usually find from Pope Francis or someone that's written about addictions from a faith-based and most times a Catholic perspective on what they've fought in their own lives. And there's a little commentary on it. And then we pray the rosary and we have some quiet time, and then people can offer intentions. And then we end with the benediction. And the whole time there's a priest that's in hearing available for confessions. And then afterwards we have some hospitality. And the first week we did it, we had over 45 people that showed up. We had some people that came and brought, a son or daughter, some people came, with the husband and wife and a couple kids, maybe praying for one of them or praying for, the son or daughter that didn't come. And the interesting thing was about a third of the audience were people that we had never seen before. And
how did you advertise this, Mark?
We put it into our bulletin, and then we're on Route 252, and we have a sign. And so I put on the sign, Addiction Prayer Night, and there were about five people that just saw the sign driving by, pulled in the parking lot.
Oh my gosh, isn't that great? That's something.
And it was, it's a beautiful thing. We average now anywhere from five people to 25 people on once a month. It's always the third Thursday of the month. And then a fellow I know who is in recovery came up to me and he said, we don't have any place where we as Catholics who are in recovery in AA can talk about, how Jesus has worked in our recovery, or St. Ignatius exercises helped me, or whatever. And so we started a Sunday night, 7:30 on the second Tuesday of the month, second Sunday of the month, an evening where those people that are in recovery, so you can be an AA, Al-Anon, Eaters Anonymous, any kind of an AA program, and they run it like an AA program. They take a step of the month, but they talk about their Catholic faith or their Christian faith and their spirituality and how that's gotten them through, like, the stage of forgiveness. And, I was reading St. Paul, and it helped me to this or that. And so people, as if an AA meeting, but it's been the very same thing. And we've gotten people come, we're in Paoli, we've gotten people that come from, the Northeast, from Coatesville, from Harrisburg, and again, about a third of the people that come, come from somewhere else, and part of that, I think, is the stigma. Some people go to confession 5 miles away at another church because they don't want anybody to see them, or they don't want their pastor to think the worst to them. I think there's still a lot of stigma associated with it. So it's a parish-based approach. And as I was going through this, I was thinking, in our parish and in most parishes, you've got doctors and lawyers and, maybe some policemen, maybe some judges. You've got maybe some counselors. You've got people that are probably in AA and probably in Al-Anon. And everybody's in their own silo, and they're not talking. And if we're to be, a true parish, and again, as Pope Francis has said, a hospital, a field hospital, we all need to be getting together and talking and taking a look on how we can address these issues, this issue that's affecting us, whether it is drugs and alcohol, pornography, gaming, all the other different things that are out there. So, our attempt is to try and start to get these people together and talk. And, eventually we would like to start some treatment houses ourselves. And, that's kind of where we are at the moment. People call me up and they say, my son's down in the basement, and he's 16 years old or 18, and he's smoking pot every day when he comes home from school. And what do we do about it? And so I usually ask him a couple questions. Does he go to church with you on Sunday? Oh, no, he has to make up his own mind, what he's doing. And, okay, are you paying his car insurance? Oh, yeah. In fact, he's got his own car. Okay, are you paying for a cell phone? Yeah. I said, well, you have some controls over the individual at that age. When it gets a little older, it gets a little tougher. But there's some research that's come out in the last 5 years about the teenage brain or the brain in general. It's not really developed in men until they're 25 to 27, in women until they're about 25. And the last part of the brain to develop is the frontal part, which is the part where the last time I drove my car drunk and I wrapped it around a telephone pole, that was a bad idea. So when you, it's really helped me in my family raising as well, is because I would used to say, what were you thinking? Well, now I know they weren't thinking. So we can get rid of that. My blood pressure does that.
The church has a lot of empty buildings. Would any of those be viable places for some programs such as this?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of, as you say, a lot of big institutions that are just sitting there. Maybe not necessarily. One of the things that I found out with many of these places is they're hard to find. And I asked one of the treatment center people, why are these places hard to find? He said, we don't want drug dealers and girlfriends to show up or boyfriends. And or if they decide that they want to leave, they wander around that rural area for 2 hours and then decide, I'm getting hungry. I need to go back where I was.
I see. Okay.
So it part of it, in talking to counselors and counselors that I know, it's you have to understand that the drugs have taken over. And if anyone doesn't believe in evil, just talk to somebody who's in the throes of a loved one with addiction. And one counselor told me that you have to understand that he's just now is his brain starting to function the way it did before there were drugs. And again, with this development of the teenage brain, the brain has to go through certain developmental periods. And if it doesn't go through that period at that age time, it won't go back and make it happen. So like for smoking, for instance, if you're a smoker for 20 years and then you stop, your lungs clean up and, you have better capacity. With the brain, it doesn't necessarily move on to that next stage. And so these Hollywood movies about the slacker, brother or brother-in-law who sits around smoking dope all day, they're really a misnomer for the public and society to take a look at. And the same thing with all these laws that are coming for, quote, recreational drugs. The marijuana today is 5 to 7 times more potent than it was in the 60s and 70s. And the illegal stuff, they're lacing it with PCPs or something else to try to get the kids hooked earlier. And there's a lot more difference. And the incidence of car accidents just came out in state of Washington that they contribute to the new marijuana law and to the kids that, I guess 18 to 35 bracket is up 3%. I think the state of Colorado has seen it up over 10%. And the problem with pot and driving, it's not like alcohol where you can do a breath test. You can't really do any kind of a test to gauge what limits someone is with pot. And so it's a whole societal issue that the politicians aren't talking about.
And we've leapt into these laws. We've just leapt into them without really thinking clearly through them. And the church has not spoken out really in any kind of, that I know of, any kind of public way against such things. No. So it's
Francis has, but it hasn't trickled down. And I think part of it, too, is that our parishes and, I'm sorry to say this, but our clergy has to stand up address the issues that people are facing in the pews today. And thankfully, our pastor, has said, look, you know, we got to talk about this. If you're having trouble, here's what we're doing. Now, we're not doing, we're growing, but at least, it's on the radar screen. We had a month or two ago, we had a call at the parish office, and this woman said, I just want to thank you for putting up that sign about praying for addiction. And so the person said, well, you're free to come in if you ever come. And she said, no, she said, I'm Jewish, but this is the first time I have ever seen on any church, sign that's on the road, pray for addiction. And if you're having a night to pray for, she said, that is so wonderful that I'm going to pray for you.
Oh, wow. So, well, Mark, let me ask you a question. I know this is on the minds of a lot of parents. I think this issue is underground because so many parents feel shame if their son or daughter is addicted. And it's almost tantamount to saying you're not a good parent, which couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, it can. As I said earlier, there's a DNA aspect to it. And there is a mental illness, depression, anxiety that's in it. I think there's a lot of pressure that we probably put on our kids. We organize their sports. We organize their playtime. We organize, their school and everything else. And kids aren't allowed to be kids. But it's not, it's not necessarily because you failed. And, it can happen, to anyone. But by the same token, as I was saying, I've got the 11 steps to enable your addicted friend or relative or child. And there's certain things that you can do when you start seeing these behavioral issues.
Mark, can you run through those quickly?
Well, it's like I said, it's don't pay their car insurance. Take away the car, take away the telephone. Don't be their banker. Don't rescue them every time that something comes up, whether they get into a scratch with the law, in the sense that you try. I remember when we had to go to court. My son was over 18, and the lawyer had to meet with him first on his own. And I knew this, and I said to my son, look, you're going into rehab. You've already agreed to do that. He's going to try to get you off, and that's great, but you're still going to go into rehab. And if you're not, then you're going to be on your own. And, these things are sometimes hard for parents to say, because they think, well, I'll never see my son or daughter again. Our son, thankfully, he was amenable to it. And sure enough, the lawyer said, what are you going to do? I told him. He said, I think you're trying to kill a flea with a bazooka. And I said, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. And I've talked to some other counselors and university psychiatrists and psychologists, and it said that it used to be that you had to wait until somebody hit rock bottom before you could do an intervention. And the problem is, for many or some, rock bottom is death. And there's a new movement in the addiction community that do interventions as early and as hard as you can to take care of the person, because once you do it later and later and later, it's harder and harder and harder. But that's hard for people, to deal with. And lots of times I've talked to parents, I've talked to husbands, and then I've talked to wives where one of the party, doesn't believe that there's a problem. And, I partied when I was in college, and I lived through it, and look at me today. But in light of the drugs, one of the reasons that the heroin epidemic is so rampant is that the drug dealers are saying, well, you can buy cocaine for $15, a bag, but you can get, or OxyContin, but you can get heroin, for $10. And not realizing that the heroin has been laced, and what used to take, two or three bags to get your high, you get it in one and a half, and that's when the know, they kill themselves by accident. But people aren't talking about that, you know. Like I said, the drug dealers have done a lot of R&D on their products, and they want to make them addictive. They want to move the kids from marijuana, you know, into cocaine and onward and upward. So the kids are thinking like, oh, you know, pot is not a gateway drug. Well, there's so much evidence now that it is a gateway drug. In fact, there's studies that have been going on in Australia for 20 or 30 years to show that there is an increase in schizophrenia among young men in their late 20s. That's attributed to early pot smoking.
Yeah. Well, okay. Listen, Mark, if people would like you to come to their parish, would you be amenable to speak on this topic? Or if they wanted to give you, if they wanted maybe to start a program in their own parish?
They can email me at mark.gethsemani@gmail.com.
And I'm sure they can find you if they call the St. Norbert's Parish in Paoli. I'm sure that the people there can get you in touch with Mark as well.
It's probably
easier to remember St. Norbert's in Paoli. And as for the Gethsemane Ways Ministry leader, that's Mark Christmeyer.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, we could go on. This program is just barely touching the surface, but I really, really appreciate this. And I know that our listeners out there, many of you are aware of addictions and maybe have been afraid to approach this in your parish. And what a great ministry, Mark. Thank you so much for bringing this to our attention.
Well, thank you. This is a wonderful thing that you're doing.
You are listening to Walking in Faith, right here at Holy Spirit Radio, WISP in Doylestown, and WCOJ in Coatesville.
Good morning, and welcome to Walking in Faith. This morning, we're speaking with Daria Little. She's written a book called From Islam to Christ, One Woman's Path Through the Riddles of God. Welcome, Daria.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Barbara.
Tell us, Daria, about your conversion to Christianity.
If we rewind back a little bit, for the first time I was exposed to Christianity, I was 19, and I met a Christian missionary. I didn't know she was a missionary. She needed a tutor, a Turkish tutor, because she was trying to learn our language, which is extremely hard for foreigners to speak. But I had never met a Christian before. The only Christianity I ever knew was what was taught by our Muslim leaders or imams or whatever book I happened to read. I had never read anything by Christians. And she's the first practicing Christian I have ever met. And she's the one who exposed the gospel to me for the first time at the age of 19. These people I tutored, they opened this Christian bookstore in Ankara, and they asked me if I could help enter the inventory because they didn't know that many people who could type in English. But I was surrounded by Christians. I mean, I wasn't Muslim, but we're in this Muslim nation at the same time.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. You were born and raised in Turkey and kind of raised nominally in the Muslim faith. This wasn't like a hardened militant Islamism. The leader of the country was trying to maybe make the religion more homogenized with the world. So talk a little bit about your upbringing.
Sure. This leader, Atatürk, he lived during after World War I when this modern Turkey was established. So he secularized the country greatly. So, like, I didn't cover my head. Actually, I never met a person who wore the hijab or niqab or burqa was forbidden in Turkey. So it's very different from other Muslim countries. It's secularized quite a bit. It's changing now under the current administration. But when I was growing up, everybody still was Muslim. It's predominantly Muslim. I mean, it's one of the most religiously homogenized countries, if not the most. So you have to be Muslim, but you can't be too Muslim or anything else. You need to be Muslim so much. So we still went to the school to learn about our history, the Ottoman history, history of Islam. And we were taught how glorious and victorious our ancestors were. But then we started talking about secularism and reformation, and we used the Latin alphabet instead of the Arabic script that we used to use under the Ottoman rule. So that's in the school environment. We talk about democracy, women's rights, and but then you go home, things are different because it is a Muslim culture. My parents didn't practice much. My mother was and still is a little more religious than my father. But everybody was Muslim, and I was taught to recite the Quran and memorize all the prayers, but we weren't allowed to cover our heads in public, or, you know, I still wore short-sleeved T-shirts. So it was kind of a mixture of East and West for us growing up.
Right. Now, talk a little bit about the patriarchy, even of the culture that you grew up in. I mean, it's different. I'm sure you find it different in America, but in some of the culture there was a sense of women. I mean, they could certainly work and they didn't have their heads covered, but there was a sense of submission, of inequality within even a marital bond. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I think it comes down to how Islam and Christianity understand marriage, men, woman. Like it's just a big... in Christianity, for instance, men and women are equal. They are both created in the image of God, whereas Islam, women are inferior inherently, and nobody is definitely created in the image of Allah, which would be blasphemous. So so it's like Allah, man, and then woman. Like in the in Sharia courts, not in Turkey, but you need two women's testimony to count against one man's. Does it make sense? So that's where the patriarchy starts. Like, women are inherently flawed. We are to be completely in submission to men. But this is not a submission in the sense that we understand as Christians to trust and guide, you know, the way the church trusts and guides Christ. It's a completely different that slave and master relationship. Again, women have to do what men ask them to do. So that's really in the strict sense, in the Sharia law sense. It happens in a lot of the other Muslim countries and most of the Middle East. But in Turkey, it was tempered because of the reformations Turkey went through about a century ago. But, of course, you cannot erase that from the culture that easily. Even though polygamy is illegal in Turkey, like my father still had affairs, and that was perfectly acceptable, and my mother was not to fuss about it, and she didn't for a long time. Or my mother worked outside of the house, so she would work full-time, but she was still expected to come home, cook three courses of meals, do everything, and my father just worked, came home, and I don't ever see him once in the kitchen because that's woman's place. So it was still that gender hierarchy is still very visible. Or in my own life, I have a brother. My brother was a lot more freer than I was. He could go and visit friends, stay with friends, but I wasn't allowed to because I was a girl. So there's definitely a discrepancy in how the genders are treated. And as I said, it's better in Turkey, but nothing like it is in the West.
Daria, I loved your story in terms of your relationship with Christ. You really exemplify the beautiful teachings of Christianity in terms of your found freedom in Christ and who Christ is. I think sometimes cradle Catholics just know from the beginning of their life the prayers and the rituals of the Catholic faith or the Christian faith. But they don't really know Jesus Christ sometimes as much as a convert would or somebody who needs to understand freedom. So talk a little bit about your revelation of who Jesus Christ was and what it meant to you.
Sure. I think everybody needs to go through a conversion experience in their lives, regardless of how you're raised. You have to own your faith at some point in life. We're trying to raise our children Catholics, but they need to make the decision for themselves at some point. But for me, I lived in the darkness of Islam and then atheism, and I've done so many things wrong, and I've sinned so much that that light Christ offered was so bright. And I think that's why converts just cling on to that right light a lot harder, because they've been in the darkness for a long time. And for me, I didn't understand what kind of God Christ was for a long time, because Allah is very different. It's very different. A personal relationship with Allah is laughable and blasphemous. I mean, it's just... it was such a different conception. And in a way, thankfully, I became an atheist first, and I tore down all those understandings of Allah or God. And then my friends helped me build back up who Christ is, and that he actually loves me as a person. This is Daria, yes, this individual, I love you, I care for you, and actually I died for you. It's a completely different understanding of God. He's rational. He wants to have a personal relationship with us. And he's also the creator of universe, before whom we should fall to our knees. So it took a long time for me to understand this. But I had to understand that I was a sinner. That was also something I didn't quite understand because of, again, Islam and atheism. And once I understood I was a sinner, so who I was and who God was, then everything started to fall into place. But it took a long time. It took years for me to see that.
Yeah, and I think it was enlightening for me to see how you think Christianity just melds in to any culture and any political system, because... allegiance isn't to the government. But you can exist as a Catholic or a Christian in any government as long as you are loyal to God. It's not a theocracy. It's not something where you need to pledge fealty to the state government religion. It's Christ asks us to be respectful of our civil authorities, but there is so much more that we're concerned about. We're building his kingdom, not an earthly kingdom.
Yes, definitely. I think that's a big misunderstanding of Christianity in Muslim countries, because they see Christianity as Islam, like a theocracy, a political system, and a religious system. But it's very different for us. I mean, we can live under any government as long as Caesar doesn't tell us to do something God doesn't want us to do.
Right. Very true. Very true. And you also talked about the judgmentalness of cultures, where it's very unforgiving. And in Christianity, you really found that Christ asks us to focus on ourselves and not worry so much about judging others. Talk a little bit about that.
It's very true. Again, I think it's an entire worldview, the difference. In Islam, you have to earn your way to heaven. Allah sets the rules, and you have to do what needs to be done. So you have your good deeds, and your sins, and they will be weighed against each other, and you'll go to heaven or hell. So in a way, everything is external. So there is no need for an internal conversion. Again, everything is external, your deeds, and you're alone in this fight. Whereas in Christianity, we know we cannot go to heaven by ourselves. We need grace. Without crucified Christ, without resurrection, we cannot. But that requires an internal conversion. Then we look at ourselves and we say, okay, I am a sinner and God died for me, and he is a sinner and God died for him as well. So it turns everything upside down. It's not an external struggle anymore. Like, you can't blame the other person for not doing well enough, because now I know nobody can do well enough without Christ, without grace. So it's a completely different way of looking at your neighbor now. Your neighbor is just somebody else Christ died for, and then you have a softer heart, or I say, you should have a softer, yes. I should have a softer heart. That's when that judgmentalism comes in. That's when forgiveness comes in. And that's when, you know, we can give people second chances or help them to become more like Christ, just like we are striving to.
We're speaking with Daria Little. She wrote the book From Islam to Christ, Woman's Path Through the Riddles of God. You know, we kind of jumped ahead. I want you to talk about how you went from atheism to Christianity. You said you met a missionary. Tell us your story.
Sure. I was raised a Muslim, and my parents got divorced, and that was a crisis of faith for me. And eventually, I became an atheist. And for years, I was an atheist, and I was also a geek, so I read a lot of scientific books. And by the time I met this missionary, I was very sure God did not exist, and science provided us whatever we needed. And I met this lady, and I just wanted to help her because she believed in fairy tales like, you know, God, Jesus, Christianity, angels. We started talking about anything and everything about God and religion. And we talked. I saw her every week for 3 years, twice a week. And I don't think one day passed that we didn't talk about God. At the end of those 3 years, you cannot prove that God exists. But she made me realize that my world view was obviously full of mistakes. And it didn't. It wasn't as consistent as I thought it was. And after all, God might exist. So the fact that God might exist was a big deal for me, because if he does exist, then I have to do something about it. I cannot just ignore him. So that's what happened at the end of 3 years. But I still couldn't follow him, because I didn't want to believe in a God who let so much evil happen in the world. So that was my first hurdle. Like, okay, God might exist, but I cannot. I refuse to believe him. So that's how it all started.
And you know what, Daria, I have to just interrupt. That is the one reason why so many people lose faith. How can God exist in a world where so much evil pervades? So I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that's a very natural question and a very hard question.
It is, but it's inherently ignores the fact that we are sinful. It's not God who is sinful. Mm-hmm. Again, what you were talking about, how we don't look at ourselves. When we look around and see the evil, we don't see what's evil in us, like how my sins hurt other people. Then, of course, somebody else's sin will hurt somebody else. It's a misunderstanding of free will and sin at the same time. But everybody has to reach to that conclusion by themselves. We can either blame God, or we can look at us and say, no, it's my fault. You know, Chesterton has this, like, what's wrong with the world? And he writes back, I am.
Right, right.
That's, you know?
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah, right, exactly right. So continue your story. I didn't mean to interrupt there.
Oh, no, of course. So I refused to believe, but then I was in college by this time, and our education language was English. So we had this Buddhist American instructor who was teaching us English, and he assigned us this chapter from Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. And I think he tried to help us see Christianity for what it is. But in this chapter, it talks about Christ's temptation in the desert, and what Christ was offered by Satan, and how he rejected these. And he talks to this cardinal during the time of Inquisition, and the cardinal says, look, you wanted the human beings to love you with their free will. You should have taken up Satan's offer and just shown them miracles, so they didn't have any choice but to follow you. You should have taken up the power, so they fell on their knees before you, but you didn't, and now they're all lost. And that was the first for the first time, I understood what God was doing. Mm. He doesn't want robots. He doesn't want slaves. He wants us to love him freely. And that's also the first time I understood how sin affects everyone. My sin affects countless people. And it's just this, we are not alone in this world, and it just has this ripple effect. And some people's sins affect more people. So that was the first time I came to grips with the problem of pain.
And
it
that was reading
God's fault.
And that's lovely. That was reading The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky.
Mm-hmm. It's just one chapter, actually, Grand Inquisitor.
Oh, my goodness.
That was the one chapter, because the book itself is quite long.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
That's great. All right, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just, you know, it's funny how we always talk about the good, the true, and the beautiful, and how literature, good literature, is always pointing towards the truth, which is God. So I just, I love that you have that example. All right, so continue your story.
Yeah, yes, definitely, I agree, because there have been many fiction books in my life that has affected me and made me understand God better, and this was pivotal for me, because now I knew that God exists. My reason, my intellect knew, but now that my heart also understood where I stood before God, that I needed grace to pass that chasm. But I couldn't make the decision. To be honest, you know, I was still in Turkey. By this time, I was going to a really good university. I was going to get a really good job in the government. All my friends were atheists. I was engaged to an atheist. I mean, my life was good, but then I came to this crossroads, and I couldn't take the last step, because, as I said, in Turkey, everybody is Muslim, and even the atheists, like, they're kind of, they don't care. They're not as dangerous as Christians, you know. The atheists kind of keep to themselves, and that was never a problem for me to get a job in the government. But once you turn, you become a Christian, you suddenly are not granted the government clearances and such. So there was going to be a lot more trouble for me if I became a Christian. I was going to lose all my friends, because we sat around the coffee table and mocked God. And now that I can't do it, I wouldn't have anything in common with them. Or my fiancé probably wouldn't be happy about me becoming a Christian after all these years. And I couldn't make up my mind, basically. I stood there and I looked, and I just couldn't take the last step. And then I'm in this, like, agony, going to class one morning. It's just quiet outside. And I see this vision in my mind's eye. I don't know if it's my mind or God slapping some sense into me. It's probably God. But I saw this outdoors, beautiful background, big mountains. There's a little girl sitting on the ground, dressed in white, and she's playing with these little toys in front of her. And she looks down, she's playing, and suddenly there are two hands coming from the sky, and they're handing this little girl a present. But these hands are so big, you can't even see the owner. You just see the hands, and this present is, like, beautiful. It's glowing. It's like, shining. You can count beyond imagination. It's invaluable. And the girl doesn't even see that this present is being handed to her. But after a while, she looks up, and she looks at the owner up off the hands, and she says, "No, I have these little things to play with." So she rejects this beautiful, priceless thing, and I'm looking at her, are you mad? How can you even compare that gift to what those measly toys you have? And that's when I understood that's what I was doing.
Oh, my.
I rejected God's grace for these measly things that I call jobs or friends. And, you know, that's the
what
first time I saw.
What a powerful image, yeah.
Yeah, that was the following day I became a Christian. And that was in 2002. I think it was about, I want to say, a month after 9/11.
Wow, wow. So what was the ramification? Obviously, culturally, you were not going to fit in there. But so what happened?
By then, I was kind of used to not fitting in. it wasn't as I thought, as hard as I thought it was going to be. I mean, I feel blessed in a way because a lot of people, they get imprisoned by their own families, and, you know, it's kind of a house arrest, or they get in a lot of trouble. But for me, I lost a lot of friends, but at the same time, I made many new friends, and I eventually had to break off with my fiancé because the relationship went down the hill, and I accepted that I can't get a government job, so I started to look for other avenues. Like, I decided to get my PhD instead of going to government. So, I mean, honestly, I feel blessed. But I'm not saying it was easy, but I think compared to God's gift, it wasn't as hard as I thought, because the Lord gives you the grace to endure hard times. So looking back, I'm glad I accepted his invaluable gift instead of the little toys I was playing with.
That's amazing. And then ended up starting another family. Talk a little bit about meeting your husband and starting your family.
Sure. So I was in Turkey for a long time. Then I became a Catholic because another friend of mine became a Catholic, and I wanted to prove him wrong. And I ended up becoming a Catholic. And I had decided to get my PhD because I thought my best shot would be staying in academia. And I was offered a scholarship in England. So I was there, and I realized that I wanted to get married. So I met my husband. The story is all in my book. I met my husband. He's an American. He was in the Air Force. I was living in England. We met through Catholic Match, and we've been married almost 8 years. We have four beautiful children, and I live in America now. I got my citizenship last year, so I never thought I would be here. If you ask my 19-year, you told my 19-year-old that this is what I would be doing when I am 37, she will think I've gone crazy. But here I am.
Well, we also share a love of Cardinal Ratzinger's writings, and I know those were really important for you. I just love the way Pope Benedict XVI writes, and he's such an immense gift. It's such an immense gift to the church. So talk a little bit about how he influenced you.
It is interesting. I didn't know who he was, and I didn't know if he was the Pope. We had no relationship with the Catholic Church, even because I was converted by evangelical Christians who thought the Pope was the Antichrist. So I had no desire to learn about Catholicism. So when my friend became Catholic, I was so mad. How could he betray me so? So I went to the library of my university and started looking for books on Catholic theology, because, again, I was so, like, I knew everything about Christianity by then, you know. And the only book they had was written by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, Fundamentals of Catholic Theology. And it's like this big, thick volume. And it's very hard. It's very hard to read. It's one of those really, you know, academic things he wrote. So I take it to my take it to the table. I open it. I try to read three pages. There is no way. I had no idea what he was saying. I mean, I have no background in Catholic theology. I didn't understand half of the words. I closed it and put it back. And this friend of mine who converted, he had sent me this little book by Mark Shea, By What Authority? And it's just this tiny little book. And I'm like, okay, I don't think Mark Shea is as hard to read as Cardinal Ratzinger. And somebody had told me that he was the Pope. Like, I didn't know he was Pope Benedict. And but after I converted, I faithfully read everything he wrote for the laity to understand. Mm. I think he's still a little bit over my head. It's more academic works, but I tell people he's my Pope because that's when I converted. So.
Oh, that's a great story. And it was the Mark Shea's little pamphlet that got you introduced to it. Was it a struggle at all for you to go from evangelical Christianity to Catholicism in terms of Were you understanding the value of the sacraments as it relates to the grace that you talked about with regards to conversion of self? And was that a big deal? Or what was the thing that actually converted your heart?
My biggest problem with Protestant theology was only Bible and only faith. Mm. It never made sense to me because I was like, so Jesus died on the cross and he left without leaving any authority. And all these Christians all around the world scattered waiting for a Bible to be put together so they could read it and learn about God. It just didn't make sense. And also only faith didn't make sense because it sounded like God took away our free will as soon as we said the prayer.
Mm.
Why couldn't we fall away? Because there are a lot of examples of in the Bible of branches cast into the fire. God never says they didn't belong to the tree. They said they didn't bear fruit. So those were the two things. And once I passed those were the main two things. There were a few others. But actually, I never understood the sacraments at that time. It took a while for me to know what the church meant with sacraments. Obviously, the biggest thing was the real presence.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing I struggle with a little bit. I mean, I understood in the Bible that I understood the theology, but the fact that there's a miracle happening every Sunday during each Mass, it took a while for me to accept that. But I read about Eucharistic miracles through the years, even now. So that helped me, like, oh, yes, this actually does happen. God can keep his promises, you know?
Right, right.
That was the biggest sacrament, the problem. The other sacraments, the understanding of it came slowly as I learned more about Catholicism.
Were you blown away by the humility of God?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's unbelievable. There's a saint, I don't know, I think it's St. Francis, who says if we actually knew what God was doing on the altar every Sunday, we would be crawling on our bellies.
Right.
Because
right.
He humbles himself so, we have to humble ourselves so, like, to reciprocate his humility. Yes, yes. And sometimes I lose sight of it, but... yes, I mean we should never. You're right. It's I always want to go back to that time I first understood what real presence meant. Yeah.
Yeah, and the incarnation, which must be a hard thing too, with regards to a distant God versus a God who would become incarnate and take on the struggles of a human.
Yes, if you suggest this to a Muslim, they will be how? No, it's like. Such a, like, it's the highest sin. It's like, it's so blasphemous.
Yeah.
Because how could you put this amazing God into the body of a measly man who, like, you know, just limit himself so.
And Daria, but conversely, allowing humanity to share in divinity.
Yes, it's exactly, but that's also blasphemous.
Right,
you know?
No. But it has to be on both ends, I would imagine. But if you think about how extraordinary that is in the history of all theology and all religions, that...
Yes, and especially if you don't grow up in it.
Yeah.
And then suddenly people offer this unbelievable notion to you, and then you realize it is true, then it's the best thing in the world.
Yeah.
There's nothing better. There's nothing else to live for but that, if that's true.
A pearl of great price, right?
Yes.
And that's
yes.
Something that you've lived. I know that was a parable in the gospel. You've actually lived it in your life. You left everything to follow that one treasure, that true treasure of God. Well, Daria, we wish we had more time, and we could probably go on forever. This is a great conversation, and I do hope with all my heart that you get a radio program and just keep talking about the beauty of our faith, because sometimes it's a convert that can express it more beautifully than anyone else. And the book is called From Islam to Christ, One Woman's Path Through the Riddles of God. We're speaking with Daria Little, and we thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me, Barbara. Thank you very much.
Thank you.